Good morning, everyone. We'll get this work session started, and I will turn it over to our leader on this issue, Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you to Commissioner Fish and Commissioner Novick who requested this work session. In retrospect, perhaps it wasn't a good idea to have it on the day of the election. So let's all just remember to breathe and be kind to each other, because I certainly am quite stressed out. Thank you to the presenters who have joined us this morning about this emerging industry. It's a little bit different from a usual work session in that we've invited folks to come and talk to us from the community. If anybody who's watching this on television wants to follow along, I just posted the link to all the documents on my blog, and rest assured that if there are any changes to be made, they'll come to council for a full public hearing where everybody will have an opportunity to present. When the council passed the initial code to launch this the marijuana policy program last September, we all knew that we would be coming back for frequent changes, as indeed Commissioner Fit Novick and I were at a City Club presentation on last Friday, and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission also said that, you know, we're learning as we go along and we get to see what's necessary to make it work. I am very committed to making sure that cannabis businesses are successful in our successful and safe in our city. And I just corrected myself, because one of the changes that I would like to make is wherever in the code it calls it marijuana, to switch that to cannabis, which is both more accurate and also less offensive to some people. So my staff in the Office of Neighbourhood Involvement have given me a lot of feedback, and we've prepared some changes. I'd like to call up Teresa Marchetti and Victor Salinas, who are two of the very stellar staff that are sitting right to my left here, and also to thank Claire Adamsick in my office, Jamie in Commissioner Fish's office, and Andrea in Commissioner Novick's for their good work in putting together this agenda.
How's that? Thank you, Commissioner. Mayor Hills and Commissioner, I really appreciate you guys taking this morning and taking the time to go through so thoroughly the program and some of the challenges that we've faced in the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. So just to start, not at the nitty-gritty, but I realize that you haven't been as immersed in this as we are, so I wanted to give just a brief history of the mission and how the program has developed to date. And then Victor will take over in going through the particulars of the application process for further discussion. So up until this point, we've really been focused on policy development that's reflective of Portland communities' values of inclusion and fairness, collaboration to ensure safety and livability, and also education in a landscape that is changing very frequently. At a recent marijuana management symposium in Colorado, the program received accolades for its public involvement and focus on equity and inclusion, which I did want to mention. I'm very proud of my team for that. Ultimately, the marijuana policy program up to this point has evolved in three areas. We have policy and public involvement, licensing and education, and then also code compliance. The third slide gives kind of a history of the program as well as marijuana or cannabis industry. In Oregon, the medical regulation program that was established for dispensaries happened in April of 2014. The first city policy advisory group was convened by this council for in an advisory capacity that came to council in October of 2014. In November of 2014, not only was recreational marijuana legalized in Oregon, but the marijuana policy program was enacted by council as well. In July of 2015, that was when marijuana was legalized for personal consumption and personal growth. Throughout the 2015 legislative session, the marijuana policy program worked with decision makers in Salem to ensure a level of local control, really learning from the lessons that we have learned from alcohol and alcohol regulation. Recreational sales began in October of 2015, prior to the establishment of any state rules at that point, which is important and really guided the framework initially in September of 2015 for our program. We began the application process in December of 2015, which is less than a year ago. I can't believe that. Oregon Health Authority rules came into effect in March. And we actually issued the first Portland regulatory licenses in May of 2016. Just to remind everyone, because it is a question that continues to come up, cannabis and marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, and both state and local regulatory bodies have used the Cole Memo and the guidelines established therein to sort of establish a cautionary approach to legalization, despite really widespread acceptance of this industry in Oregon and in Portland in particular. So what we did know last year, at the time that we adopted Chapter 14B.130, we knew that we had an unregulated medical industry. The Oregon Health Authority had limited capacity to address the dispensaries. We also knew that recreational sales were beginning in potentially 132 dispensaries. We housed over half of the dispensaries in Oregon, in Portland, and we had no state rules in place. We also knew that saturation and adherence to the code memo guidelines were a priority that had been established, and that there was, at that point, no state authority, and at this point, too, over illegal locations or sales. We did know that there were existing illegal locations. We didn't know to what extent those locations that looked, that walked and talked like dispensaries, but were not actually regulated by the OHA or held any kind of state authority. We didn't know how many dispensaries would choose to sell recreational and would eventually convert, although we assumed it would be a high percentage. And we also didn't know what other jurisdictions would do, what the landscape would be. They had an opportunity to opt out or enact a regulatory framework or not. So what we really focused on was establishing expectations for Portland specifically and for the urban environment that's here. It's well established in social sciences in general and the basis for most rules and regulations that there's always about 10% of really good actors that are going to take into consideration a number of different factors regardless of the rules and regulations that are in place, and that they're going to be stellar. There's always also about 10% of bad actors who are not really motivated by rules and regulations. So we went into it with the intention of establishing community expectations that would motivate that other 80%. Because as you can see on the bell curve in your packet, where individuals fall on that spectrum can be close to the bad actor side, can be close to the good actor side, but they can be motivated by established community standards if they're understood well. So Portland was, the Marijuana Policy Program enacted Chapter 14B.130 to meet specific goals. Responsible integration of the industry. We really focused on the environmental impacts related to livability and public safety. Our collaboration with the state in an area that we did not focus any regulations on were product safety, financials, and applicant backgrounds. Those were established at the state level in a uniform capacity, but with the differing jurisdictions and the differing needs related to urban, coastal, rural, we really focused on that. We also focused on the unlicensed locations because there was no state authority to address those particular locations. And that brings us to the past year. We have focused in those areas. Go ahead.
You just insert this at some point. Maybe it's, I was looking to see if it's in your presentation. You mentioned other jurisdictions a couple of times.
Yes, sir.
Just a glimpse of what's happening outside of the bubble.
Absolutely.
Okay. Sorry, missed that.
Absolutely. That will be coming. Thank you.
Teresa, one more interjection.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I'd like to spend some time on is what bad things did we expect bad actors to do? What kind of behavior did we anticipate would happen without this set of regulations and permits? And how did this set of regulations and permits and fees prevent the bad behavior we're worried about?
Absolutely, and we will get to that as well. We'll go through what led to the development of the application process and the particular rules and regulations, and then also give you a snapshot of the complaints that we've received so far and what has surprised us and what we were prepared for. So we have really focused this year on education and licensing of the industry in particular. Community education has also been a primary focus, collaboration with other jurisdictions and other organizations, but the majority of the program's resources have really been spent on encouraging and coaching the industry into compliance. And Victor is going to take over and walk you through that.
Good morning, Commissioner Fritz, Mayor Hills, and the rest of council. Thank you for seeing us today. I wanted to give a quick recognition for our staff, our marijuana policy program staff that have been working very diligently to make sure that we are working with the industry and all of our applicants to be able to help them navigate our application and licensure process. So they've been doing an amazing job, and I just wanted to recognize them. Could we have you stand? Thank you. They're an awesome team. So as Teresa mentioned, you know, our main focus has been on education. One of the things that we knew was that the regulated industry was new for all of us, for the industry. And so one of the things that we wanted to make sure is that we met people where they were at. At times, some of the industry applicants may not have known how to navigate a licensure process, may or may not have our zoning process requirements, working with the Bureau of Development Services to be able to get the permits, their buildings up to code. So our application process focused on that. So in terms of who needs a City of Portland marijuana regulatory license, that would be medical dispensaries on the medical side. On the dispensaries, we wanted to focus, again, on the environmental impacts. So that is why we focused on solely specifically on those and the limitations that we have with producers as far as restriction to information through HIPAA laws. On the recreational side, we focused on marijuana retailers, the processors, those that make edibles, extracts, topicals, producers, those that cultivate marijuana, and then wholesalers, those that distribute between the different licensees. As I mentioned, we don't regulate medical marijuana producers or medical marijuana processors because of confidentiality at this time. On the recreational side, also, we do not regulate laboratories or research facilities. We do provide...
Excuse me, Victor. You qualified that at the end by saying not at this time. Is it if there were some change in the law or some change in policy, would you recommend that? Are you considering extending regulation to the producers and processors?
As far as the producers and processor, there are some life safety hazard impacts that I would be inclined to support the regulation of those businesses as well on the medical side. And in a little bit, we'll get to some information as to what has been the impact for particularly a medical processing facility in Astoria that wasn't properly permitted, and what we are trying to avoid by proactively ensure that marijuana businesses meet building code requirements. Thank you, Commissioner. So the first step that we do with our applications is we look at the minimum standards. We make sure that the businesses are in a fixed location, that they are 1,000 feet away from schools for as far as the consumer-based businesses. So see, these would be the recreational retailers as well as the medical dispensaries so that we limit the exposure to young people. We also make sure that the marijuana retailers and the marijuana medical dispensaries are 1,000 feet away from each other. So a medical dispensary to medical dispensary has to be 1,000 feet. Marijuana retailer to marijuana retailer has to be 1,000 feet away from each other. And a medical dispensary and a recreational retailer, 1,000 feet. So basically 1,000 feet for all consumer-based businesses. And that was to limit the saturation in any given area of the city.
It was also something we were asked by industry representatives and also medical facilities that who had been doing business for some time, and they wanted to have a fair shot at being able to convert, as you said earlier.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. Yeah, that was the big a request and a suggestion made by industry at the hearings when we were presenting our recommendations on for local regulation of marijuana businesses. MJ, shorthand for marijuana. So moving on with the zoning requirements, council passed Portland City Code 14B.130, which restricts marijuana businesses from being able to site in residential zones. So these would be RF through RH. The state requires that on the recreational side, that they not be in zones exclusively zoned for residential. On the medical side, they don't allow any businesses in the residential zones, but we wanted to make that uniform given the landscape of the city and, again, to limit saturation.
Just to call attention to that one of the mistakes that some of the businesses have made is that they wanted to locate in a residential zone. We don't allow retail in any residential zone, so that was something that the policy staff helped people understand.
And we wanted to be reasonable as well, right? Some, for example, the city of Denver does not allow the businesses to the dispensaries to establish within 1,000 feet of residential zones. So that is something to take into consideration as well. As I mentioned earlier, one of the areas of the few areas that we were partnering with the state was around the state's licensure process and the processing of land use compatibility statements for recreational businesses. So we process those using our minimum standards along with the application when an applicant submitted a license to a site within the city of Portland. So I'll walk you through our application procedure. To start off with, I want to mention that we do and focus on education. So one of the things that we did was in the fall, we hosted two forums for the industry to help them understand and be able to navigate our licensing and application process. We also have been continuously enhancing and updating our website to make sure that information is easy to find and accessible and that is available to our applicants, to the industry, but also to our community to learn more about this newly regulated industry and as it's establishing here in the city. So as far as the materials and the requirements, there's a page specifically for our website where people can find checklists that of materials that they need to have prior to submitting their application, as well as the documents and materials that they need to have prior to licensure. So if an application is complete, we direct folks to our website so that they can request an appointment. We've been able to speed up the process of signing up folks for an intake appointment. It is now within 1 to 2 weeks. Somebody can expect to get their intake appointment to submit their application. During that intake appointment, our staff goes through the application with the applicants to make sure that the documents required to submit their application are there, and as well to let them know what documents they're missing and they'll have to have within either 6 months for producers, processors, and wholesalers, or within 60 days for medical dispensaries and recreational retailers. That's part of that educational process and that assistance that we provide to the industry to be able to navigate the process, knowing that some of the documentation required takes some time to be able to compile. So again, we go through the initial review. If they meet the initial review requirements, we accept and then process an application. Once that happens, then we go through the documentation to make sure that they meet the minimum standards. And we also make sure, as part of the minimum standards, that they meet the distance requirements. If they do not meet the minimum standards, then the application would ultimately be denied. If they do, then it moves on. We moved on to the final inspection. The final inspection happens after that initial review in order to make sure that the actual physical space is up to the requirements for the city, that they have all the required permitting, and to make sure that we are able to draw the physical footprint of that business, of the premises, to establish the permanent 1,000-foot buffer requirement.
Does the Bureau of Development Services have any role in any part of this regulatory process?
Absolutely. Yes, we collaborate with them closely. One of the areas where we work closely with the Bureau of Development Services is with the zoning. So one of the documents required to be able to submit an application is a zoning verification map to make sure that they are aware that that they're in the proper zone. And that's one of the opportunities for applicants, that if they find that they are in a residential zone, then at that point they can make the business decision whether they want to apply or not. But they don't have to spend the whole application fee if they know that they are not in the appropriate zone.
So there's been a lot of collaboration between the cannabis staff and both the Bureau of Development Services and also the Fire Bureau, because like any business that opens in Portland, there are some minimum standards that have to be met regardless of what you're selling.
Absolutely. And another area that we collaborate with them is to help folks be able to navigate. We were meeting early on since the creation of the program to develop our minimum standards, to develop the requirements, to see where our code requirements intersect, and to be able to help applicants be successful in navigating the process. Again, you know, it took some time to smooth it out. It was a learning process for both the city as a regulatory body and for the industry going through our process. But it is now, we've been able to help applicants navigate through it much more smoothly. We've had some issues regarding the number of applicants that are going through and the time that it takes, but overall the collaboration is going really well, and especially also addressing unlicensed locations that pose a life safety hazard to the community.
Victor, if an applicant is well prepared and coached and has done his or her homework, what is and they enter the system when they submit an application, what is your benchmark for approving or conditionally approving it within a reasonable period of time?
Thank you for your question, Commissioner. So initially it was roughly about 8 months that we took when we first started. Now where we're at in the process with the team fully, with being fully staffed and with now that we've gone through the bulk, our process has really become very efficient. We can, if an application is complete, we are able to process it roughly within 45 to 60 days from application submittal to license issuance.
So let's turn the page and go through that.
So again, after the final inspection, we go through a final review, and then we go into the conditional approval until we receive proof of a state registration through the OHA or license through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Some of the issues that happen, if, for example, in the initial document review, somebody's missing a document, then we'll notify the applicant so that they can provide that. And we also have built in some safeguards so that if it's going to take somebody longer to meet that requirement because of the coordination that it takes between bureaus and agencies, then there is an opportunity for an applicant to request an extension to submit that documentation. Ultimately, if it's out of their control and because of saturation with the workload in bureaus, then they will get an extension as long as they're doing everything they can in their control to be able to do that. So then moving into the final inspection, if they find that they are they're not meeting the requirements for the final inspection, that they're given 2 weeks to remedy that and be able to then have staff come, our compliance staff come back and do a follow-up inspection. And then at the end, in the final review, we just do, you know, to make sure that we have another set of eyes going through the application before we issue a license, we have folks review that application. And ultimately, at that point, with a conditional approval, if somebody is not issued a state license for multiple reasons, whether financial reasons, safety, or because they don't meet the evaluations around background and product, that product safety or their financials, and at that point we would not issue a license if the state does not. So a snapshot of our program, we've received 506 applications to date. We've approved 94 applications, 49 have been in conditional approval, and 9 applications have been withdrawn. So that speaks to the efficiency of our program to be able to maneuver through these applications. One of the things that was helpful is the speediness and the work that the staff really did to coordinate with OLCC around October 1st when they were beginning to issue those licenses for the first recreational retailers. Our staff, Brandon and Lena, Christina, and Steph really did an excellent job at coordinating with them so that transition happened smoothly. And I just want to commend their efforts for that.
Can we just clarify again, when was the first date that someone could submit an application?
The first date that somebody could submit an application was December 7th. I'm sorry, December 1st. And those were for grandfather applications, if you will, for those dispensaries that had been operating within the city already. If you recall, one of the focuses was that for those businesses that had already been operating fully compliant and fully meeting all the regulatory frameworks and the code compliance for the city, that they would have had a city license had it not been for the fact that it had not been established. So you approved as part of the code to be able to have those businesses go through the application process first and expedite those. And then starting on February, that's when we started accepting applications for all other medical dispensaries, for all other marijuana, recreational marijuana businesses. We did start getting appointment requests for those starting back as early as December. And that was through our lottery, starting as early as November, and that was through our lottery process. In order to avoid having folks standing out in the rain and the inclement weather, we devised a plan to be able to establish an order in which we were going to accept applications to avoid any heavy crowding and having people stand in line and having to come back. So people requested an intake appointment, and then we drew a lottery to establish the order in which we were going to accept those applications.
Just a time check. We have about 10 minutes left for this section. So we could talk more about the license requirements, or we could move on to demographics, where they're located, complaints, etc.
So we had 500 applications in year one. Yeah. How many do you expect in year two?
In year two, we expect that approximately about 200 to 250 applications. Some would be for renewals. For the ones that are already applying, and some of these would be unique new applications as well, depending, I'm assuming that's going to depend on just the market, the demand, and the landscape as it continues to evolve.
And I also want to add that this first year has really been focused on the medical dispensaries. The recreational market has just started to be licensed by the OLCC, and so applicants for processors and producers have been less than what we would expect in a typical year for recreational producers and processors. And so we do know anecdotally, and especially from Denver's experience, that has been a growing population of licensees, and we expect it to be the same here.
Thank you, Teresa. So as far as the application requirements, they have to submit personal history forms. But again, we leave the background check to the state, since that is already a thorough process. A zoning verification map that they obtain from Bureau of Development Services. A land use compatibility statement for the recreational business, recreational marijuana business. A marijuana control plan, and I want to highlight this because this is one of the things that I had an opportunity to discuss in detail with many of the other local jurisdictions at the Marijuana Management Symposium in Colorado. And this is a tool that we use. It serves a similar function to a good neighbor agreement or a launching point for that, to introduce the business to the neighborhood, to the community, so that the community knows what the expectations are for these businesses, but also to know how to be able to connect and contact them should they have any concerns or any complaints, so that they can be the first point of contact for any issues that may arise, that could potentially arise.
So that's a requirement that's specific to the marijuana industry. We don't normally have that for other businesses.
That's correct. The marijuana control plan was reflective of basically a good neighbor agreement. There's a series of questions that takes them through thinking through livability. There is no right or wrong answer necessarily, but it does direct them on a uniform basis how to consider their neighbors and the environment that they're doing business in. And it's an opportunity, too, for them to introduce themselves to the neighborhood. It's posted online so that if neighbors do have a concern about a particular location, the primary contact is there for them to collaborate with, and as well as neighbors are able to see what strategies have already been put in place for public consumption and loitering around businesses, and so that they can see that the industry has already been reflecting on those potential issues and has a plan in place.
So how does that...
I need to clarify, there is a requirement for a good neighbor agreement for convenience stores in the zoning code. So in some ways, these businesses are kind of like convenience stores in that there's lots of people going in and out, but not necessarily spending a lot of time there.
So 7-Elevens have to do the same thing.
Thank you, Commissioner. So as far as that, I want to mention that it's also as part of our equity and inclusion focus. We make that available in all the 11 safe harbor languages. So the information goes out that these materials are available, and then upon request, we'll translate them into the requested language for people with limited English proficiency. Other requirements that we have are that they meet the commercial building code requirements for the city. Thank you. Sorry about that. Moving forward in the slide there. So again, we make sure that this is a way to be proactive in making sure that these businesses are not posing any life safety hazards to the community. And this is, again, specifically important for the cultivators and the processors given the processes that they use and the chemicals that they work with. They also have to provide...
I've got to interrupt you again, Victor.
Absolutely.
I'm the timekeeper because we've got lots of people to hear from. So the council has this packet. Maybe
okay.
We could skip to more towards the end of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely, Commissioner.
One question on the application submittal. Are all of these documents public records, or are some not public records?
So the documents are public records, and in the event that there's a public records request, we notify the applicants so that they can let us know if any of them are proprietary information or if there's any reason why we should not make that, or we need to redact any information.
So maybe this is a dumb question, but why is a security plan a public record? Isn't that sort of like me posting, you know, the window that doesn't work in my house that you can enter the house through, or the door that's not tied to the alarm, or my hours of work so people know when I'm not home?
Yeah, so the security document is not actually shared publicly or made publicly available without a public records request. And in the event that there is, like I said, then we notify the applicant so that they can make the decision whether they want to make a request and not make that publicly available. So what is posted on our website is the marijuana control plan, not the security plan.
So I'm going to just help us skip through to some of the things that council has wanted. If there is a map, if you could get to that, that shows whether three marijuana retailers, and remember that the recreational full permit has only been in effect since November 1st. So that shows that. Then if you look at the next table, if you can move to that on the PowerPoint, we're looking at statistics by neighborhood. There's already some concern that we're getting oversaturation in some areas, particularly East Portland and the Southeast Uplift area. That's just bringing that to everybody's attention, because I've been visiting I went to 25 neighborhood associations the last 2 months, and that's a concern I've heard over and over again, is the number of businesses and wanting to take care of that. So then we can skip. I'm sorry, I'm taking over your presentation, but we do have a lot of people to get to. We've got the license rules and requirements, including no consumption on the premises and all the other safe harbor things. And then we've got license rules and requirements, and again, you can go that. Let's skip to the program statistics.
I just have this is such an excellent PowerPoint. Please indulge us for a second, because we're trying to absorb a lot of information. Do you have anything other than anecdotal information as to why there are so many applications in East Portland and Southeast Uplift? In other words, do we know whether it's demand-driven? Do we know whether it's the market in terms of the cost of space? Do we know whether there are other factors? Have you teased that up?
We don't have any hard data about that. There is some supposition, but there's no hard data.
So let's get to the program statistics page, showing there's been a lot of requests for information, 234 complaints. Are you going to go into the types of complaints we've received?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Commissioner. So there's been 234 complaints logged. A lot of the complaints, some of the common themes are opposition to marijuana businesses siting in a specific neighborhood, and this is as a result of the public notification that we do to inform the community of businesses that has submitted an application to our program. There's also many of the concerns that we have are around proximity of marijuana businesses to schools, parks, and daycares. And again, I just want to highlight real quick that we decided not to recommend minimum distance requirements to parks, daycares, community centers, that type of amenities, again, to avoid saturation in East Portland, where there has been underinvestment and infrastructural inequities in that area of town, to avoid having businesses saturate that area.
So one of the functions of the program is that the staff there kind of acts as a buffer between a convener between the neighborhoods and the businesses. And we've, in fact, done a lot of education to the neighbors that know this is allowed and how they can get to know their retailer.
And Commissioner, just to highlight that, really it's about the requests for information have been probably one of the greatest values added by this program. We've fielded more than about nearly 5,000. That number is not accurate. Requests for information from both industry and community about what are the expectations, what is allowed, and our staff makes it a point to respond to each one of those in person if possible, and as quickly as possible.
So then there are some life safety concerns as we've listed out here. The links were emailed to each of you and to your chiefs of staff, and they're available on my website, particularly in relating to processors. There have been several fires. If you turn the page on the statistics in Colorado, there's increasing concern about explosions.
Commissioner, may I jump back for a second? Do we have a breakdown of how many complaints of each type there were, like how many odors of marijuana complaints there have been, how many complaints about public consumption and loitering? Because you've got the 234 just sort of grouped here without a breakout.
Yeah, thank you for your question. We don't have that information here, but that's something that we can provide and make available to you.
And the five, I would also like to know more about the five violations.
Yeah, absolutely.
These are egregious something, so I'd like to know what categories.
Yeah, all five violations were for operating without a marijuana regulatory license.
But I do want to highlight that there were 94 warning letters, which was basically the initial check or the initial notice given to people who were found or were under suspicion of operating without a marijuana license. And out of that, only five violations actually occurred, because we really have focused on collaboration and education to make sure that they know how to be compliant if they can, or that they can't.
And again, I apologize for pushing everybody along and remind you that in a normal work session, we would have spent about 2 hours just going through this information. If you can now turn over to the other jurisdictions in Oregon near us, those are listed out there where some of the cities have opted out. Lake Oswego has on the ballot this year to opt out entirely. And then there were questions before. If you turn over to the page of marijuana regulation comparison, we've done a detailed comparison on some of the cities, and you also have a spreadsheet in your packet that lists out every single jurisdiction in Oregon, both cities and counties, and says what they're doing as regards to regulating. So obviously we don't have time to go through that, but I want to commend the staff for doing a lot of research. And basically it's all over the shop from don't allow anything to Gresham, which is very restrictive, which has no schools, childcare facilities, parks, or religious institutions. If we were to do something like that, we'd basically be zoning out as indeed Tualatin has almost zoned out except for a very small area of industrial land. It amuses me greatly that they're still asking their voters to approve the 3% tax on recreational marijuana sales, even though they don't have any businesses there. So we were also asked to compare the state rules and the Portland rules, and so that information is in your packet as well, in your briefing. And then we've particularly looked at where state rules and Portland rules may duplication, and that's how we can streamline that. So we are going to be coming back at the end of the presentation with a series of suggested code changes to acknowledge that we could do better. We've done a fair amount, a lot of public outreach in addition to the industry, also to the community members, so that they can understand what we are talking about. So I realize that was very rushed. It's now actually 5 minutes past where we're supposed to be finishing for this section. So let's move to comparing the state and local regulations with Jesse Sweet from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and Andre Osso and Christopher Westfall from the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, welcome, and just push the little button on the base of the microphone so that we can get you on the record.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I'm a senior policy advisor with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm going to be running through our rules very quickly because I know we're pressed for time. But before I get started, I think some background on the state agencies would be helpful. In the state of Oregon, we have one plant that is regulated by three different agencies according to three different bodies of statutory law. The OLCC covers the recreational marijuana program. OMMP, which is the gentleman to my right, cover the medical program, and the Department of Agriculture covers the hemp program. I think within the community there is some confusion about the lines between OLCC and OMMP. Especially with the Early Start program that began in October of last year. Although medical dispensaries now have the ability to sell recreational marijuana to consumers, that is happening entirely within the OMMP system. OLCC does not have any regulation over those dispensaries. Likewise, when we get our licenses up, which we're starting to do on the retail side, we are going to allow medical patients to purchase tax-free at our licensed locations, but again, that is recreational marijuana regulated entirely by OLCC and not the medical system. So Measure 91 was passed in November 2014. The 2015 legislature made major revisions to the measure, as well as the 2016 legislature. Before beginning our rulemaking, the OLCC did an extensive public outreach tour. We visited 11 cities in the state of Oregon to get citizen input, and we also had online surveys and a very extensive website. This all led to our first set of temp rules being adopted in October 2015, and since that time, the rulemaking has been ongoing. Due both to the legislative changes, which I referenced, and to our continued learning about the industry and refinement of our rules. As a matter of fact, the current rulemaking is underway, and we have a public hearing on November 17th for the latest revisions to the permanent rules. The purpose of these rules was pretty simple. We have a statutory mandate to adopt rules necessary to carry out the provisions of the statute and protect public health and safety. That's our general mandate for rulemaking. We also have very specific mandates throughout the statutes. For example, we were tasked with setting the canopy limits for grows. We're tasked with setting license fees and standards for child-resistant packaging. And there's a laundry list of things that we have to do in our rule. We've really covered the agency from soup to nuts statewide. We have over 90 pages of rules currently adopted with the OHA rules on testing and labeling incorporated by reference. So these cover conditions for licensure, conditions for operating, violations, fees, canopy limits, requirements for participating in our seed to sale tracking system, which is a real-time inventory tracking software system designed to prevent diversion. And I think we will be in this constant state of rule revision for the foreseeable future. You know, the cliche is that we are building the bike as we ride it. You can use whatever cliche you like, it applies. We have a lot of learning to do, despite the fact that I feel we've made great strides over the last couple of years. Like all state agencies, we do a fiscal impact statement for our rules as required by the APA. The impact, as of right now, is indeterminate. It's difficult to do a detailed cost-benefit analysis on these rules due to the fact that the scope of the rules is so broad, also due to the fact that we really have a lack of data at this point. As of November 4th, we have licensed 302 producers, 46 retailers, 14 wholesalers, 17 labs, and 7 processor licenses.
Go back to just something you said. Just caught my attention. You said that in terms of the cost benefit, you've been unable, it's indeterminate because you don't have enough data to reach a conclusion. But you do have a framework that you use to make that judgment. You may have inadequate data. And could you supply us with that framework and the kind of considerations and maybe an analogy, an analogous area that's been regulated where their cost benefit was resolved? Because I think we don't often get to, it's rare in our process to actually do a cost benefit. It's usually a regulatory requirement. But I think it may be helpful to us in looking at some of these things. So if you could give us some follow-up on that, I'd appreciate it.
As I'd mentioned previously, all state agencies are required to publish a fiscal impact statement when they adopt rules. However, for all state agencies, these statements are often indeterminate. We look at impact to the public, both impact to the regulated industry, impact to the state agencies, impact to local jurisdictions, impact to citizens. So, for example, in the case of marijuana industry, if you look at it as a whole, we've got some positive impacts to the economy. People are being hired, taxes are being paid. But the regulations which we have promulgated come at a cost to the industry. We're requiring security systems to be implemented. We're requiring that they use certain software. It is a fairly tight regulatory system. And then we're also considering impact to the community, which is fairly difficult to quantify. We've heard some concerns about these businesses and neighborhoods, but you know, frankly, as compared to the bars and taverns that we regulate, we haven't heard that many. So all of those things are considered, but for the reasons I've stated, it's difficult to actually produce a number. So we have an analysis, and that's an analysis I can forward on to the council if they're interested to see it. So moving on to statistics, we have I just mentioned the licenses that we have issued. We have approximately 1,000 applications that are in review or awaiting review. The average processing time is 75 days. A lot of that is dependent on the applicant and dependent on the local jurisdiction, how quickly they produce the Lux statement. If an applicant has their Lux and has all their ducks in a row, it can go much quicker. Sorry for the alliteration. I was also asked about complaints. Since June of this year, our general marijuana line has received 236 complaints. However, only 60 of those complaints were related to businesses that had a license or an application with the OLCC. Because we're out there and we're public, people often call us for all things related to marijuana, and it turns out that the complaint may be a medical grow or a completely unregulated grow, and at that point, we really can't do anything about it. The numbers were 236 complaints since June of this year, with 60 of those being related to businesses we license. So we've seen some complaints about smell, we've seen some business disputes, some employment issues. In rural areas, we've seen complaints about water use, and we've also seen some complaints about advertising, but I don't have a breakdown by type to offer you today.
Thank you very much. If you could send us that information, that would be really helpful. Thank you. Let's move on.
Just a quick comment, if I can. I know we're concerned about schedule, but there are three seemingly unremarkable bullets here that have to be, I think, flagged, and that is lessons learned from alcohol. One, urban needs differ because of close proximity of communities. Two, livability and safety are key concerns to local jurisdictions. And three, promoting collaboration and integration is important. I'm a veteran going all the way back to 1993 of the struggle between OLCC and cities about how to work together. And the fact that those words are on the page is really significant, because now we have this great working relationship on liquor licensing over the last few years, where there really is a shared agenda. And I just want to commend the OLCC, because there were long years of conflict and denial and finger pointing between two levels of government, and we're not there anymore. And I just want to commend you and the rest of the OLCC staff for believing in those three things, because it's really working.
Thank you, Mayor, for pointing that out. And Teresa Marchetti was in charge of the liquor program.
Yes, she was.
So I appreciate both everybody working together on that.
It's different in the urban environment that, you know, Prineville doesn't have a last Thursday, but we do. And, you know, you've been really adroit at working with us and dealing with those realities.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor Hales. I appreciate that. I lived through the dark years, and I can tell you it's much better now.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask you to turn your light off so that we can, it has to, everybody, okay. We have to take it in turns here.
I have one bit of closing remarks, if I may. I was asked what's coming next. As I mentioned, we're in a constant state of refinement. We have heard about some legislative concepts that would allow for social consumption in some form, and also some form of temporary event license, which would allow marijuana to be sold or perhaps consumed at these temporary events that we see around town. So those are two things that may be coming next, and I'm going to leave the council with copies of our business readiness guide, which is a guide for licensees and applicants, so that they can comply with other regulations, not those contained in our rules.
Now, when you say social consumption, you're not talking about a party at Steve Novick's house. You're talking about people that can come to a business and use drugs on a registered licensed premise. Is that what you're referring to?
That's what I'm referring to, yes.
Thank you, council members. My name is Andre Uso. I'm the manager of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program within the Oregon Health Authority. And to my right, the gentleman is Mr. Chris Westfall, and he's the compliance manager of the program. So Mr. Sweet gave a pretty good overview of the overall marijuana regulation of the state, and I'll just add a little bit at the high level and any specific questions we're here to answer, and any compliance-related questions Mr. Westfall would be happy to answer as well. As Mr. Sweet alluded to, that right now the OMMP is the only, or as of the fall of this year, was the only state program licensing marijuana facilities in the state of Oregon. That began in 2014 with the dispensary program, and that was medical only dispensaries. As of October 2015, with the legalization and Measure 91 implementation, the legislature allowed for limited retail sales of marijuana from medical dispensaries and facilities throughout the state, with the exception of those counties and localities that have opted out. That early start period extends from October 1st, 2015 to December 31st, 2016. As of January 1st, 2017 of this year, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program will not be selling, those facilities will not be selling any sort of retail marijuana to consumers. As of the first of this year, all of our facilities will go back to strictly medical only, so patients must come and present a registry identification card if they would like to purchase any of their medicine. That being said, we currently still have about 400 dispensaries licensed in the state. Historically, about a third of those are in the Portland metro area, so it's a rather dense registration area for the state. We are seeing a transition of those facilities with either withdrawing their registration, turning it in, or withdrawing an application for that registration as they make a decision that they want to transfer over to the OLCC system. We continue to renew dispensary applications on a regular basis, and we continue to issue new dispensary registrations within the city and within the state as well. So we do not have quite have the accurate numbers on how many of those facilities we anticipate making a switch over to OLCC fully, but based upon surveys we did earlier this year, we anticipate about 85 or 90% of our medical facilities will make a transition over to full retail licensure under OLCC. We've also started reviewing processor applications. Since April 1st, processors could apply to the Oregon Health Authority to manufacture marijuana products. We've started issuing what we call readiness letters in September to those facilities, saying that they have 60 days to fully comply with all the registration regulations, and then they submit that readiness letter back to us, and then we have 30 days to set an inspection. To date, I think we have one facility that has submitted and said that it is ready for an inspection. So we anticipate that the issue here is that these facilities are allowed to continue to operate without criminal liability until December 31st, 2016. So they're making a decision whether they want to stay within the OMMP system or transition over to OLCC. And those are business decisions that they are timing with the end of the year. So as of December 31st, 2016, if a processor is not registered with the health authority or licensed with the Liquor Commission, they must stop operating all processing of marijuana or risk being criminally liable. So I just wanted to talk about a little bit about the average time for submitting applications and receiving a license. For a new dispensary application, it takes about 3 to 4 months, 90 to 120 days to get fully licensed. A lot of that has to depend on the business and their readiness. So once they have a complete application in, we'll send out that 60-day letter, and they have 60 days to get the remaining regulations complied with before we set up an inspection. Processor sites, as I mentioned, those are starting to, we've started issuing those letters, but we'll see how they trickle in into the for the rest of the year. So as far as this council wanted to know a little bit about overlap between state regulations and local regulations, in our rules, we generally require a general compliance with state and local building and fire code. However, our inspectors are not trained on assessing those specific regulations for each locality, but if they do notice something out of the ordinary, they are they do call the locality and report that complaint there. So it is a reference. Those sorts of complaints are referred over to the local jurisdiction. If we do notice some extreme issues with compliance on building and fire code, but they're generally, we do not have extensive state regulations for build outs or for fire and safety. We do have security requirements. Cameras need to be in place, and areas of ingress and egress are strictly regulated as well. I think that's pretty much the 10,000-foot level for the state of regulation here with OHA. If you'd be happy to answer any questions.
I had a question. So Mr. Sweet, I think you mentioned that the average processing time for a permit is 75 days. So
yes, that's
so
correct.
We're kind of, you know, we're less than 75 days till January 1st. I'm just wondering, are we, what's going to happen? Are most facilities, because you mentioned I think only one facility so far has made the transition. So are they likely to just remain medical and then at some point convert to retail? Because you anticipate 85 to 90% will become retail.
Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, a lot of that will depend on the business's ability to get their application materials completed and into the authority so that we can schedule an inspection. The dispensaries, it's not so much of a big deal because 400 are already registered, about a third of them in Portland. So it would be just the matter of them surrendering their OHA registration and then picking up their OLCC license. The processors is a different issue. So we do have those processors that we've issued readiness letters. It does depend on them to get that information back. So if they're not either registered with us or licensed by OLCC by the first of the year, they're going to have to stop operating.
I would also add on the OLCC side, we have a number of applicants who are ready to go, but they're waiting to flip the switch, if you will. It seems that people are trying to time, retailers at least are trying to time the market to enter the recreational system in December.